all, you know, it's the import that we, the export that we have is weapons, and it's the mainstay of our economy. It's we're in you know, we don't have anything else to offer the world right now that anybody wants. I think we're also dealing with climate change and a frantic effort to maintain the control over the over fossil fuels instead of looking for alternatives. The biggest part of the budget for the Department of Energy for the United States is developing nuclear weapons. It's not looking for renewable alternatives to fossil fuel. It's not looking for independence. It's looking for control of other people's oil.
Okay.
You know, while we build more weapons.
Thank you very much for that, Daniel Lazar, author and journalist. Brian Terrell, thank you so much, political commentator and peace activist. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikova Tabway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Happening hours ago, the Israeli military launched a massive raid into the Palestinian town of Jenin, killing and injuring over a dozen people. The European Union's top diplomat advises EU states to stock up on weapons as their arsenals are running out due to oversupplying Ukraine with arms. And Russia is not impressed by the change in UK leadership, painting a gloomy picture of the future relations under Liz Truss. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the Israeli military has conducted another deadly raid in the occupied West Bank, killing a Palestinian man and injuring 16 others. Regime forces shot dead 29-year-old Mohammed Sabane during the raid, which targeted Jenin refugee camp on Monday night. According to Palestinian media reports, large groups of Israeli forces stormed the camp from several directions. 100 military vehicles as well as bulldozers were reportedly deployed to Jenin. The troopers evacuated Palestinians, including children and women, from their homes and helped them outside. They also arrested several Palestinians. Jenin has seen almost daily Israeli raids over the past weeks. That's amid escalating tensions across the occupied West Bank as Israel steps up its crackdown on Palestinians. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Moana Kandil, to get more details on the Israeli raid.
Well, the operation to Jenin area was in the first place meant to destroy or demolish the home of Palestinian martyr Raad Khazem, who carried out a shooting operation in Tel Aviv. Of course, Israeli forces raided the building where the apartment of Palestinian martyr Raad Khazem was included, and the clashes took place between Palestinians and Israeli forces. We are speaking about a large number of Israeli soldiers and vehicles. According to witnesses, over 100 Israeli military vehicles and a bulldozer raided Jenin area, and it was the largest number of forces storming the city in the recent months. Of course, we are speaking, according to Palestinian paramedics, about one Palestinian martyr, Mohammed Sabani. 16 Palestinians were wounded during this operation, and a number of Palestinians had been arrested also during the Israeli storm to Jenin area.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip have held a big rally to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa prison break. A year ago, six Palestinians humiliated the Israeli regime through their daring and heroic escape from the Gilboa maximum security prison. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
Palestinians have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa prison break, also known as the Freedom Tunnel operation. In September of last year, six Palestinian detainees escaped from the Gilboa maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine. They managed to get out through an underground tunnel in the prison's drainage system. Hamas resistance movement has vowed to secure the release of Palestinian detainees.
On the first anniversary of the heroic Gilboa escape operation, we salute the six prisoners. Securing the release of all prisoners is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. The six escapees will be on top of the list of any future prisoner swap deals with the Zionist entity.
The Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions. The prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Palestinian prisoners escape from Israeli prisons because of the horrible detention conditions. They suffer from inhumane treatment, and hundreds of prisoners are held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention.
Palestinian prisoners regularly go on hunger strikes and protest at the regime's administrative detention policy and harsh conditions. Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
We call on all international human rights organizations to step in and protect Palestinian prisoners. There are thousands of prisoners, including children and women, in Israeli custody. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from all forms of oppression inside Israeli jails.
Currently, around 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, are languishing inside Israeli jails.
People here consider Palestinians held in Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters who continue to struggle under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shannan, Gaza.
The European Union's foreign policy chief says member states are running low on weapons because of the scale of arms deliveries to Ukraine.
The military stocks of most member states has been, I wouldn't say exhausted, but depleted in a high proportion because we have been providing a lot of capacity to the Ukrainians.
Borrell also said he regrets that the EU did not begin training Ukrainian forces a year ago when some member states called for it. This follows informal discussions last week on an EU-level military training mission in Ukraine. The EU has already provided 2.5 billion euros in military assistance to Ukraine since the war began in the country last February. The figure includes a 500 million euro aid package approved in July. In Germany, protests are spreading against high living costs and rising energy prices as Western sanctions on Russia take their toll on the Europeans. Thousands hit the streets of Leipzig in eastern Germany as part of, quote, hot autumn protests in the country. Regular Monday protests have been planned against soaring energy bills called by parties on both the left and right of the political spectrum. Protesters are urging the authorities to do more as bill payers feel the squeeze from rising prices. On Sunday, thousands of protesters marched in the western city of Cologne. They demanded that German government drop the sanctions it has imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Relations between London and Moscow are already at their worst since the Cold War, but they could plunge into a new low with the election of Liz Truss as the UK's Prime Minister. The Kremlin says it cannot rule out the worsening of ties, even though, quote, it's hard to imagine anything worse. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the UK leadership contenders, namely Truss and Rishi Sunak, competed with each other in anti-Russia rhetoric and threats. Just weeks before the war started in Ukraine, Truss made an acrimonious visit to Moscow, where she had the Russian foreign minister openly engaged in a war of words. The UK has since become a staunch supporter of Ukraine in the war with Russia, providing it with weapons and military support.
Liz Truss has begun celebrations after winning the race to become the new leader of the ruling Conservative Party, making her the next British Prime Minister, beating her rival finalist Rishi Sunak and taking over the post from her predecessor Boris Johnson. The Foreign Secretary, who won 81,326 votes of Tory members to the former Chancellor's 60,000, takes over from Boris Johnson, who was ousted by his own MPs earlier this summer.
I'd like to pay tribute to my fellow candidates, particularly Rishi Sunak. It's been a hard-fought campaign. I think we have shown the depth and breadth of talent in our Conservative Party. Friends and colleagues, thank you for putting your faith in me to lead our great Conservative Party, the greatest political party on earth.
The feeling of joy over her victory will not last long. Truss has taken over a car crash economy and a so-called zombie government. Building a new cabinet, formulating an effective energy plan, and figuring out how to remove pressure of the severe cost of living crisis are all top of the agenda.
Things in Britain do need to change. We need some new policies, because what's been happening recently is there's a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis. Inflation is at its highest amount for several decades now, and this is alarming. Britain's economic future is quite bleak. Businesses are suffering. Indeed, there could be the position that many factories may have to close, perhaps temporarily, because simply they cannot afford the fuel bills. So something, in a sense, must be done.
Truss inherits a deeply divided party, lagging in the polls, and a long line of past scandals have left many experts fearing lasting damage to Tory electoral prospects. Truss won't officially take over until Tuesday after a meeting with the Queen alongside the outgoing Mr. Johnson. However, her next big fight will be to convince the wider electorate that her premiership has a future. Robert Carter, London.
As Europe grapples with an unprecedented energy crisis, Iran has expressed readiness to fulfill its role as a major oil producer free from any politics. Iran's oil minister says the world needs its crude supplies and the country can improve global energy security. Javad Oji pointed to the surge in natural gas prices in Europe, saying this will fuel demand for oil in the continent. Iran's oil is one of a number of three sectors targeted by U.S. sanctions. This as Europeans face rising energy bills and shortages as the cold season approaches. The crisis has been aggravated by tensions with Russia over the war in Ukraine. Moscow has indefinitely halted its gas supplies to Europe over technical issues it blames on Western sanctions. Russia says it will most likely reduce its oil production by around 2% and lower its gas production by 7% this year. The coordinator of the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal says the recent exchanges between Iran and the US have left him less confident about a prospect of a quick agreement.
But I'm sorry to say that I am less confident today than 28 hours before. about the convergence of the negotiation process and about the prospects of closing the deal right now.
Borrell says the EU's draft text was initially well received and parties seem to be converging on a common point. However, he said the latest interaction is diverging. The EU foreign policy chief expressed concern, saying the whole process is in danger. Iran and the US have been engaged in indirect diplomatic back and forth talks over the EU drafted text to revive the accord. Tehran says its latest response was transparent, constructive, and lawful. It has called on the US to show political will for a deal, saying guarantees on the removal of the sanctions are necessary for any agreement to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. University Professor Fouadi Zedi tells us what's keeping the JCPOA rival talks from succeeding.
We have the majority of the U.S. Congress opposing the nuclear agreement, JCPOA. We have people in the Biden administration that oppose it. We have the Israelis and the Israeli lobby that's trying to sabotage what's going on with the talks. Yes. And this is the problem that the U.S. has. Instead of basically pointing out to the difficulties that they have, they are starting this blame game against Iran. And the Europeans generally don't have the will or the ability to stand up to the United States. You know, Europe is going to be facing a very cold winter with gas and oil shortages. Europeans say that they are still in JCPOA, so they can buy oil and gas from Iran or at least try to engage in trade activity that's going to result in less pressure on European citizens. It seems they're willing to have a cold winter and not disobey the United States, which is very strange for Europe.
An entire community in the U.S. has been left without safe tap water after floods damaged a long-troubled treatment plant, causing its breakdown. Now the city of Jackson, Mississippi's state's capital, has declared a state of emergency. This catastrophe has sparked widespread concerns about firefighting, sanitation, and residents' health. But the issue runs deeper than just dirty water in what has been called environmental racism in the United States.
A catastrophic failure, but one that didn't just happen with the Pearl River flooding, one which has in fact been ongoing, which includes the lack of maintenance of water pumps. In 2021, water pipes froze, leaving people with no water. Later in July 2022, residents were advised to boil water after concerning test results. Some even say that for the past years, there's not even been a month where citizens in South Jackson particularly have not gone a weekend or 2 days or even sometimes a week with either no flow of water or one without water pressure. Now, after nearly 1 week of misery, the Federal Emergency Management Agency director says it's too early to say when the people there will have clean running water. But the situation in Jackson had been alarming for years now, and the infrastructure had clearly been worn out. So why is it that officials there are just realizing that something needs to be done?
There is an issue in the United States called, quote, environmental racism, unquote. And environmental racism is quite common, quite prevalent in the United States. You see this not only with regard to water supply, you also see it with regard to where garbage dumps are located. You see it with regard to where toxic waste dumps are located. So what you see as we speak in Jackson, Mississippi, is no shock, it's no surprise, it's utterly predictable. Because we also know that Mississippi happens to be the state in the United States that has the most sizable percentage of black residents.
Mississippi's largest city is more than 80% black, and this has led many to believe that this is why the city's water system has been neglected for decades. It is also one of many black majority U.S. cities suffering from a major water problem. But until Jackson can restore its water treatment plant and fill its aging pipes, residents will have to make do with boiled water, bottled water, and plenty of patience.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
in the limelight.
Reading about Europe's energy crisis in newspapers or hearing about it on TV or radio news sections may shock everyone. But in reality, this crisis is worse than what is described in news headlines. With days left to the cold seasons in this continent, a spiraling inflation and soaring energy crisis have worried European families. Experts have warned that this crisis may transform into a catastrophe in the upcoming month. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details about this issue. The title of this article is Europe's Energy Crisis May Become Catastrophe in Months Ahead. Stay with us, please. In the eyes of American news publication Foreign Policy, you have no idea how bad Europe's energy crisis is. With this headline, Foreign Policy wrote, "If most of the world is struggling with higher energy prices, Europe is being stretched on the rack, forcing European leaders to improvise bailout plans and emergency measures to spur consumers from damaging economic pain come winter." The biggest problem is spiking natural gas prices, which have been wreaking havoc across the continent, turbocharging inflation, hamstringing industries, and making ordinary people shudder when they get their power bills in the mail. European natural gas prices are now around 10 times higher than they were on average over the last decade and about 10 times pricier than in the United States. Alex Monton, an expert on global gas markets at Rapidan Energy Group, a consultancy, said European natural gas is so expensive it's like paying $500 for a barrel of oil, and these are the good months. Monton said things are at a crisis point, adding, "We have astronomical gas prices, and we're still a few months away from when gas demand really peaks during the winter. There is genuine uncertainty whether there will be sufficient gas to meet demand throughout the winter." Foreign Policy continued, "The gas problem is largely due to Russia-Ukraine conflict, which has disrupted exports of Russian gas to Europe and raised prices everywhere else. But it's not just the war. Alternative supplies of gas are expensive. Climate change has drained rivers so much that many of Europe's nuclear plants are offline. And there has been more than a decade of confusion among European policymakers about how to build shock absorbers into the system. Power prices in both Germany and France reached record levels this week again, a reflection of the continent's ever-deepening power emergency. As nations buckle under the economic pressures, desperate times have called for desperate measures. Britain announced a painful 80% spike in the cap for household energy costs, while Germany increased bills by almost 500 euros. Time also on the energy crisis in Europe wrote, "Until blackouts begin or pump prices make driving actually unaffordable, most people generally think no more often of energy than of air. In many other places, especially Europe, the escalating situation is impossible to ignore, and it's going to get a lot worse. The worst has yet to come. In cold weather, the heating season, consumption draws mainly from fossil fuels, especially natural gas and oil, because most heating systems are still petroleum-fueled. Like every year, demand for natural gas will thus increase dramatically come winter. With Europe dependent on Russian imports for over 40% of its gas needs and 46% for coal and 27% for oil, Russia has a lot of leverage. Euronews came with a worrying headline saying Europeans' worry cost of living crisis will cause social unrest. Many Europeans worry that high inflation due to the current energy crisis could fuel social unrest, protests and strikes, according to a new survey in France, Germany, Poland and the UK, conducted by pollster YouGov for the non-profit organization More in Common. The survey showed that cost of living has become the most important issue for Europeans in the four countries polled. A majority of people surveyed in all four countries said they were worried about social unrest in the coming month. In France, 4 in 10 people said they wanted to see a return of the Yellow Vest protest movement. Europeans are also feeling the impact of energy crisis. 1 in 5 people surveyed said they were drawing down from their savings, while 1 in 10 said they were skipping meals, the survey showed. Many are already struggling to cope, having to draw from savings or skip meals, particularly among disengaged and low-trust segments of the population, according to the report from More in Common entitled Navigating the Cost of Living Crisis. The vast majority believe this won't be a short crisis, with many seeing no end in sight. A majority of those surveyed in Poland and Germany said they were shopping around for better deals on groceries. A majority of those surveyed said they expected to cut down on heating this winter due to high energy prices. The survey also showed that the Europeans in the four said countries had low trust in their government's ability to handle the crisis. It found that while overall people don't trust any political party to handle the crisis, opposition parties, including populists, are making gains. In the UK, trust in the Labour Party was 20 points higher than in the Conservatives. In France, the party most trusted to deal with the crisis was the far-right National Rally. Pessimism seems to be widespread across Europe. Few Europeans expect that the cost of living crisis will end anytime soon, with over 1 in 3 people surveyed uncertain that it will ever end. Majorities in the countries polled would like to see an accelerated transition to renewable energies and believe renewables are a way to achieve energy independence faster. The polling was conducted online in late July with a sample of 7,000 adults from the UK, France, Germany and Poland.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The leader of the British Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer, has been conducting a witch hunt against pro-Palestine members of his own party. His notoriously pro-Israel views are well known. But today, we'll be looking at Sir Keir's relationship with a little-known but influential law firm called Mishkan Diriya. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to delve into the background to this story. But before we get into that discussion, here's Bianca Rahimi with an investigation about the role of Mishkan Diriya in pro-Israel lobbying.
Mishkan Diriya is a law and lobbying firm based in London and Singapore. It is a vast operation, including over 600 lawyers. It generates hundreds of millions of pounds of profit yearly. But what lurks behind this tidy veneer? Mishkan Diriya came about through a merger by Baron Victor Mishkan and Barlett Diriya. Victor Mishkan had secretly worked as an intermediary between Israel and Jordan, providing his home as the site of meetings between Israeli President Shimon Peres and King Hussein of Jordan. Victor Mishkan later went on to reign as vice president of the Board of Deputies, a lobby group in Britain which has admitted having a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy and strong links with the Israeli military and Ministry of Strategic Affairs. The law firm and lobby group has a special section which focuses on Israel-related activities. It claims to provide a seamless service to numerous Israeli institutions. What are some of those institutions? Documents have revealed that in 2003, Mishkan Diriya acted directly on behalf of the Israeli embassy and then President Ariel Sharon. It has sponsored events for the UK-Israel Tech Hub, which is headed by Haim Shani, a former director general in Israel's Ministry of Finance. One particular Mishkan Diriya event acted as a launch pad for Cyberbit, a cybersecurity subsidiary of Elbit Systems. The law firm proudly boasts that it advises the University of Haifa and the Hebrew University of Jerusalem on BDS campaigns against them. It is also known that Mishkan Diriya approached other companies to help them take on BDS protesters on a pro bono basis. It was also essential in the campaign against Corbyn, advising both the Jewish Labour movement and key anti-Corbyn MP Margaret Hodge. Palestine Declassified can also exclusively reveal that several of Mishkan Diriya's employees have simultaneously worked for Israel lobby groups. For example, the deputy chair of Mishkan Diriya, Anthony Julius, is also chair of the opaquely funded Jewish Chronicle. In addition to that, he is a founder of Engage, which was set up to oppose the campaign to boycott Israeli artists, musicians, writers, and teachers.
We can't really quite explain why it's wrong to attack Israel in the way that Israel is attacked by our enemies. Anyone who is irrationally hostile to Jews or a Jewish project, the project of Jewish collective action, Jewish collective existence, which is Israel, is an anti-Semite. End of story.
Jonathan Cummings was simultaneously working for Mishkon Dereya and was director of the Israel office at Britain's largest Israel lobby group, BICOM. He later went on to be an advisor to the office of the President of Israel. Amy Bokstein went from Mishkon Dereya, where she worked in PR, directly to BICOM. Jonathan Betesh worked for the Israeli Intelligence Corps, then worked for the Israeli Embassy in the UK, before working for Mishkon Dereya. Rachel Rose worked for Mishkon at the same time as being a fellow of the New Israel Fund. She later went on to work for Center Countering Digital Hate, which shares its office with the Labour Together project led by Israel lobbyist Trevor Chin. Olivia Gordon interned at Mishkon Dereya and then went on to work for the Conservative Friends of Israel. So here we have a law lobbying firm deeply bonded to Israel at every level of the company. Watch out, Mishkon Dereya could have you on their hit list.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. We're also joined today by Tasneem Akunji. Tasneem is a criminal defence solicitor working in the field of terrorism and terrorism-related offending since 1999. He's got extensive experience of how prevent the government's counter-terrorism strategy targets Muslims. In March 2015, he was involved in advising the families of three schoolgirls who left Bethnal Green Academy and travelled from East London to ISIS-controlled Syria. Welcome to the show. Tasneem, now, as a solicitor, you must have come across Mishkon Dereya a fair bit. I mean, was the material in that investigation there about their links with Israel a surprise to you?
I wouldn't say that it was a surprise, but the depth of it is certainly eye-opening. It's not uncommon for law firms to orient themselves towards a particular sort of client base. But when you have lobbying as part of a law firm, then that may raise some eyebrows with respect to, if you have a very large customer base, whether or not you have conflicts of interest arising out of that and whether they're declared.
Yeah. I mean, David, tell us more about Baron Victor Mishkon.
Well, this is going back sometime in history now, but he was one of the two people who came together to form the partnership, which was Mishkon Dereya. And he was a Labour Lord in the House of Lords in this country, and he was of such stature in relation to the Israeli government that he provided his own home for the negotiations between King Hussein of Jordan and Shimon Peres as part of their plotting together to marginalise the Palestinians, of course. So he had a sort of a role which was really quite influential, both in the Israeli state and in relation to the British state. And it's that kind of role which has gone forward with Mishkon Dereya's activities up to the present, as we saw in the film there. Really a huge slew of involvement with the government of Israel, the state of Israel, working directly for the embassy and indeed for Ariel Sharon and many other cases which we've already touched on.
Tasneem, I mean, tell us what, in your opinion, you think is wrong with a law firm being hired by the Israeli embassy.
I mean, there's nothing illegal about it at all. The issues really arise about the activities more widely and generally. We've had certain investigations done by other media outlets into the role of the Israeli embassy and some of their, frankly, illegal activity using spies to infiltrate the political networks in the UK, all caught on tape. And then you have operatives in the UK who don't declare themselves as spies, namely Shai Massot, who, when this documentary was released, then leaves the country.
This is the Al Jazeera documentary.
It is indeed.
The lobby.
Yes.
Yeah.
We also have Mishkon Dereya implicated in documents from the Panama Papers, particularly to do with setting up entities that allowed for tax avoidance or maybe evasion by Erdogan's, I think, son-in-law, really. And also Mishkon Dereya has more recently been fined a record at some for money laundering. When you put all of these things together, one has to start questioning, well, do all these things have synergies? And are they being properly investigated with respect to the impact they may have, given that they're deeply embedded with the politics, they're deeply embedded with finance internationally, and they're deeply embedded with lobbying? That's not to say any one of these things are particularly problematic, But when you have criminal fines for money laundering, which is a criminal offence, then you start wondering about the ethics of it all.
I mean, you mentioned about, you know, being properly investigated. I mean, are they being properly investigated then?
Well, I mean, they were certainly by the SRA, and the SRA imposed a record-breaking fine on them, which is over $300,000. It was 200-something thousand pounds. Yeah. And the real difficulty is that how do you penetrate international finance? And that's always been a problem. Mm-hmm. We've had issues in the UK with VAT fraud, for example, and the cost of even investigating that, even though the sums stolen from those sort of activities are in the tens of millions of pounds, the costs of investigating that, even for our criminal justice system, far exceed that. Mm-hmm. So there's a level of international organisational operation that is almost beyond investigation.
Mm. David, I mean, the lawyer in charge of the misinformation submitted in your case was a guy called Adam Rose, as I'm sure you recall. I mean, he's a partner at Mishcon, and he seems also to have significant roles in other areas. I mean, tell us about that, can you?
Well, the misinformation was, of course, that it was said by the president of the Bristol Jewish Society, Edward Isaacs, that he had been attacked on social media as a result of statements that I had made. And they provided information on this to the case that I was involved in. And the information was provided by Mishcon de Rea, and it consisted of fabrications. It consisted of, first of all, of the material not being from social media, but from private Facebook chats, and not being from multiple individuals, but being in relation to one individual, and not actually, of course, being anything to do with anything that I had said. So there was a level of deception in there, which can only have been deliberate, and Mishcon was involved in that. So that's the first thing I would say. Now, the second thing, of course, is that he is also a trustee of the Union of Jewish Students, the national body representing Jewish student groups, which is, of course, a Zionist organisation. And so he has that additional role. And the third thing to mention, I guess, is that he's also the chair of the board at JCOR, the Jewish Committee on Racial Equality, which opposes as a Jewish anti-racist organisation. But when you've got someone who's such a committed Zionist chairing the board, you've got to start to ask questions about the kind of anti-racism which is being pursued. And I think this is a more general question we have about the extent of Zionist influence on the anti-racist movement in this country, where there are certain questions of racism which are ruled out of court. And those, of course, are Islamophobia, first of all, and secondly, anti-Palestinian racism. The ability to call out what the state of Israel is doing in occupied Palestine as a form of racism is something which is systematically marginalised by those Zionists who are involved in the anti-racist movement, like, for example, Adam Rose.
Yes. I mean, when Jeremy Corbyn was elected as the leader of the Labour Party, he was probably the first anti-imperialist, pro-Palestine leader that the party had ever had. What role do you think Mishcon had in actually killing Corbynism in this country?
Well, it wasn't the only organisation. There were many Zionist organisations involved in this.
But Mishcon in particular, what role do you think they played?
As we saw in the film there, they advised the GLM, which of course is the Jewish Labour Movement, part of the Labour Party, but again, a formerly Zionist organisation signed up to the World Zionist Organisation in Jerusalem and signed up to their charter, which means that they have to adopt a racist position on the question of Israel. And also Margaret Hodge, who famously was involved in trying to destroy Corbyn and was not, as should have been the case, simply summarily expelled from the party and has now, of course, been welcomed back after she resigned in half. That her Zionist views weren't being paid attention to. So clearly it played a significant role along with a number of other Zionist organisations in attempting to destroy Corbyn. The GLM, you'll recall, was behind one of the complaints to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission inquiry into anti-Semitism, which of course itself was mired in conflict of interest issues. And so we have all sorts of ways in which a company like Mishcon de Rea were involved in the campaign to, as you put it, kill Corbynism. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I think we have to kind of move on now to look at another report that we've got about Mishcon de Rea's involvement with the British Labour Party.
As Labour leader, Keir Starmer has gained a reputation as an obedient manservant of Israel by targeting pro-Palestinian members and hiring former Israeli Military Intelligence Unit 8200 agent Asaf Kaplan as a key employee of the party. If we were to follow his servility to the Zionists to its lair, we would end up at the controversial Mishkan Deraya. Starmer was paid over £125,000 in the employment of the strongly pro-Israel lobby group and law firm, slyly pocketing £750 an hour. He even received £25,000 from the firm while serving as a Member of Parliament. Labour MP David Lammy has also been employed by Mishkan Deraya, and both he and Starmer have been funded by Israel lobbyist Trevor Chin. It's unlikely that Lammy would mention it while teaching a course dealing with settler colonialism at SOAS University in London. Mishkan Deraya were implicated in the 11.5 million documents of the Panama Papers, which exposed political figures hiding billions in tax havens. Mishkan Deraya is listed as an intermediary for the offshore entity Black Eagle Shipping, which helped the sons of Turkish Prime Minister Binali Yildirim evade tax in their homeland. Mishkan Deraya is also listed in the papers as connected to Linklaters, which played a key role in setting up the offshore entity Miracle Securities. A Maltese journalist who played a vital role in the coverage of the Panama Papers, Daphne Caruana Galizia, was assassinated by a car bomb in October 2017. Following her killing, her sons alleged that Mishkan Deraya harassed her leading up to her death. They accused the law firm of trying to financially cripple her, stating the campaign for justice in her mother's case cannot be disentangled from the abuse that she suffered at the hands of Mishkan Deraya's lawyers. In January 2022, it was ruled that Mishkan Deraya would pay a record fine of $315,000 for multiple breaches of UK money laundering laws. It's also paying the Solicitors Regulation Authorities £50,000 cost. It sounds like Mishkan Deraya are perfect bedfellows for the witch-hunting, vote-rigging Labour Party of Keir Starmer.
What do you think Sir Keir Starmer's relationship with Mishkan Deraya tells you about him?
Well, I mean, he was a consultant for them. His policies that he's affected of late, as well as even during the Corbyn era, I think the report into issues that took place in the Corbyn era under his watch showed that there was a hierarchy of racism, and that hierarchy of racism put anti-Semitism at the very top of that, so that was given a priority over any other form of racism. That seems to be not dissimilar to how the Zionists in Israel treat everyone else apart from the people who are indigenous to Israel. So the policies that are inside the Labour Party are very similar to the policies of a synergy with the policies in the State of Israel as well. Also, the Labour Party adopted the definition of anti-Semitism that's been used to target academics.
Working definition, yes, indeed. They make great play of claiming that their sister party is the Labour Party, which has a very checkered record in relation to its kind of racist stance on a number of different areas. But, David, I mean, what do you make of this secret trip by David Lammy to Israel and his role at SOAS teaching about settler colonialism? And there's a degree of hypocrisy, to say the least, isn't there, going on there?
Well, I must say, David Lammy is the MP for Tottenham, and as many people might recall, the former MP for Tottenham was Bernie Grant, who, a doughty fighter against racism of all sorts. He would never have made a secret trip to Israel on behalf of the Labour Friends of Israel, and nor would he have taught a course on settler colonialism, which missed out the Zionist entity, the Israeli state, from any such class. I mean,
it's the most extreme form, isn't it?
In today's world, you know, there are hardly any more extreme forms of settler colonialism. Looking back at the history, of course, we can look at Northern Ireland, look at Algeria, South Africa, and many other places, including, of course, the US itself. But no course on settler colonialism can be complete without thoroughly examining the record of the occupation of Palestine, the continuing occupation of Palestine and the ethnic cleansing there. So a whiff of hypocrisy, certainly, but this is a sign of where the mainstream Labour Party is going, a total subservience to the interests of the Israelis, not just in relation to a kind of sense that this is a joint enterprise, that there are shared interests between the British ruling class and the Israeli ruling class. No, this is about the capture by the British elite, of the British elite, by the Zionist entity. And I think we should be very clear about this, a state capture. Mm. This is not it performs a useful function for the British ruling class to take on the ideas produced in Israel by the Zionist state. This is actually a capture by the Zionist state of key elements of the elite culture of this country.
Indeed, because not just the Labour Party, I mean, it's very significantly involved in the Conservative Party right across the political spectrum. But Taz, I mean, I think you touched on this in the first segment a little bit, but I wonder if you maybe say a little bit more, because Mishkon Daria were implicated in the Panama Papers, and, I mean, is it common for law firms to assist in large-scale tax evasion? I suspect the answer is no.
I think it depends on the law firm. Any law firm that starts offering services to high net worth individuals will create entities for them offshore that are tax efficient. Now, there's a difference between tax evasion and tax avoidance, as Rishi Sunak likes to point out quite a lot. Yeah. But the issue then becomes, well, what's moral, what isn't? Are lawyers the arbiters of morality? They're not. They are the tools that clients use to achieve goals. So on their own, it's not something that's problematic for a law firm to be involved in. However, if they start creating schemes whereby these are provided as services for tax evasion or can easily switch into tax evasion, that's a criminal offence. Mm. And in that particular case of Mishkon Daria, the grey area was stepped over in terms of money laundering, which is a criminal offence.
Sure. I just wanted to move into another area, because I understand that you know about the contract that's held by Mishkon Daria to train magistrates on breaches of security industry authority rules. I mean, can you say a bit more about that?
Sure. It was some years ago, but Mishkon Daria were the law firm that were training magistrates in terms of how to deal with SIA breaches. Now, the security industry authority, they're the ones that license security guards and people who look at CCTV cameras and what have you. Now, these breaches, when they occur, they are dealt with inside of a magistrate's in a criminal context. But the rules that are used in terms of the balance of evidence are on a civil basis, so balance of probabilities rather than the criminal sort of test, which is beyond reasonable doubt. So magistrates were trained in this because it's a little bit outside of what they normally deal with. However, what was interesting about that was Mishkon Daria simultaneously had the contract for prosecuting any breaches. So they're sort of training the judges, but also prosecuting in front of them. And on its own, that's interesting, but it becomes more interesting because Mishkon Daria, of course, were the lawyers who dealt with and represented General Pinochet. And in that case, they successfully argued that Lord Wolfe were removed as one of the judges because his wife was a secretary in Amnesty International. Yeah. So they established the precedent that even a tenuous link for a judge or an arbiter would mean that they should recuse themselves from quite probably on judging on issues that they had some potential interest in. But of course, that link was much stronger in the case of the SIA, and so it was rather improper for them to be training the judges as well as prosecuting in front of them.
I mean, Pinochet, of course, being the notorious Chilean dictator, but it seems to me that you are suggesting that Mishkon Daria are engaged in some sort of sharp practice. Would that be a fair assessment, really?
Yeah, no, Mishkon Daria, in terms of sharp practice, they're quite well known for that. Mm. We've seen in terms of the Maltese journalist that her sons speak about her being harangued by Mishkon Daria, threatening to effectively bankrupt her if she didn't withdraw journalistic stories that she'd investigated and written on. This is before her murder, of course. But that's on a particular level, even at a much lower level, where Mishkon Daria had a contract to sue companies that were reselling computers that had illegal copies of Microsoft on them. The practices they employed in that were on the edge of ethics, really. So even at the very lowest level, they employ the same sort of haranguing tactics and have been pulled up for it.
Mm. I was going to ask you, David, actually, about the Maltese journalist, Daphne Caruana Galizia, I think is how I have pronounced her name incorrectly. Apologies for that. Just briefly, we'll just say there from Tasnim about this very serious allegations that were made against Mishkon Duriya. The family say that they harassed her right up until her death. I mean, that's pretty bad, isn't it?
Well, it was particularly bad given the manner of her death. She was murdered in a car bomb. Pretty extraordinary thing to happen to a journalist in a peacetime situation.
Absolutely.
And, of course, there's no suggestion that Mishkon Duriya were engaged in activities which led to her death. But nevertheless, the fact that they were haranguing her for her activities as a journalist and trying to have her material as a journalist withdrawn, presumably in the defence of clients' interests, is a pretty murky kind of affair and not what you would expect law firms to be directly involved in if they were playing by the rules. Normally, you don't have journalists having their copy threatened by direct legal threats.
Yes. Well, I'm afraid the clock has beaten us again. Thank you to Tasneen and obviously to David, our resident expert. We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
In the limelight.
The energy crisis in Europe is getting worse day by day. With the escalation of illegal US and European sanctions against Russia after the country's special operations in Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin reduced gas exports to Europe. This action has worsened the energy crisis in Europe and caused people to worry about the coming cold days, especially